Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast. I'm your host, Des Latham. Episode 227, a turning point not just in our nation's past, but in the arc of 19th century global history. For soon, the earth will yield its glittering secret, the diamond, and with it fortunes will rise, empires will stir, and the southern tip of Africa will be irrevocably transformed. But before we reach that seismic revelation, we journey first into the twilight of a king's life, to the basalt crown of Thaba Bosiu, where Moshoeshoe I, the great architect of Basutu unity, faced the gravest challenge yet to his people's survival. The year 1864, a new figure steps onto the Veld's political stage, Johannes Brandt, recently elected president of the Orange Free State. With his arrival came the end of the internecine Boer squabbles. Now, unity of purpose would drive their ambitions, and that purpose turned towards Basutoland. Brandt lost little time in invoking Article 2 of the Treaty of Aliwal North, a clause etched into colonial parchment defining the boundary between Free State territory and Moshoeshoe's realm. He wanted it honoured and in the Boers' favour. The British High Commissioner Philip Wodehouse's successor to Sir George Grey responded, dispatching Aliwal North's Civil Commissioner John Burnett to parley with Moshoeshoe. There, among the towering ramparts of Thaba Bosiu, Burnett argued the line was law. The Warden Line, drawn in 1858, marked Moshoeshoe's northern limit. Yet Basutu families still tilled and dwelt across it. Not out of defiance, but memory, for those lands were ancestral, soaked in history and spirit. To demand a retreat across the Caledon River would have meant inciting his own chiefs, rupturing the very fabric of the Basutu world. Brandt, determined to halt the Basutu's slow advance towards Harrismith and Windburg, convened the Volksraad. A special session summoned Governor Wodehouse, pleading for intervention to preserve peace or impose it. By October 1864, Wodehouse had the contested boundary beaconed, but in a private memorandum shaped by voices like Burnett's, he concluded what Moshoeshoe already knew in his bones: no treaty or beacon could reconcile the irreconcilable. While the Free State clung to the ink of 1858, a document where Moshoeshoe had affixed his name to the Warden Line. But treaties are made on paper and people live on land. To the Free State, the matter was closed. Watertight demand, they insisted, and by the strict letter of treaty law, they were correct. But Moshoeshoe spoke a different language, one older than parchment and ink. His was the voice of memory, of ancestral dust and sacred hills. The land, he reminded all who would listen, was Basutu before it was landmarked. Rights flowed not from treaties, but from time, tradition, and toil. To bolster his claim, he compiled meticulous lists, names of chiefs, of clans, of homesteads that once stood proudly on the plains, now disputed. He was no stranger to politics, but he was also a custodian of the past. The boundary, he said, had been drawn under the shadow of pressure. The British surely would see reason. They would not allow the peace of the interior to be shattered. He wasn't wrong in this hope. To lend weight some vuma to his case, he pointed to the spectral remnants of Basutu life in those occupied, contested lands, crumbling kraals, stone foundations, the ghostly outlines of what once had been bustling villages. "If the day of equitable settlement has come," Moshoeshoe wrote in a dignified letter to Wodehouse, "have these people not a right to be restored to their old habitations? All these chiefs are now in my country, and I say, behold, and judge between us." It was an appeal as much to Abraham as to the governor, a plea not just for justice, but for vision. Wodehouse, to his credit, listened. He was moved by Moshoeshoe's logic, by the quiet dignity of his claim, yet he remained at heart an administrator of empire, bound to the sanctity of signed agreements. Thus it was, in the dying months of 1864, that the governor departed Cape Town and journeyed deep into the heart of the Highlands. He arrived at Jammerbach Drift, where land and legitimacy collided, and met Moshoeshoe and his councillors beneath the basalt gaze of Thaba Bosiu. Determined to understand the terrain firsthand, Wodehouse rode northeast, tracing the liminal lands all the way to the headwaters of the Caledon River. Riding at his side was Civil Commissioner Burnett, flanked by Free State emissaries. And from Moshoeshoe's camp came a proud delegation too: Tsekedu, Madapo, Mopedi, Modetsani, Tlali, Men of counsel and kin who carried the weight of a people's memory as they rode with the British and the Boers. A curious procession that was, this mounted band of adversaries and emissaries, tracing hoofbeats through one of the most breathtaking stretches of South Africa, the veld, awakening in the first blush of spring. They rode from ridge to ridge, from valley to stream, the scent of the blossoms on the air and the cries of birds weaving between silences. Yet beneath the surface of this pastoral theatre, tensions simmered. Wodehouse, ever the rational imperial steward, later confessed to being unsettled. The land he saw teemed with hundreds of Basutu, entire communities living amidst the shells of Boer farms, between 50 and 60 homesteads left desolate and weather-worn. To his ordered British mind, this was an affront to civility and legality. No matter how deeply he sympathized with Mashweshwe's case, this would not do. And so, when the cavalcade reached the far northern reaches of the Caledon River, they turned back and retraced their journey, and Wodehouse, in full view of both the Boer and the Basutu, began to physically mark out the warden line once more. With hand outstretched, he named the landmarks, the peaks and the passes, the stony ridges and river bends, each a fixed point in the fraught geometry of sovereignty. Wodehouse ordered Mashweshwe to ensure his people left the area to the north of that line, and also urged Bran to allow chiefs full time for the removal of Mashweshwe's people from the farms on which they are living. Once home, Wodehouse sat in Governor's House and wrote a private letter to his son. What the political results of my mission will be, it is hard to say. Yes, as with all clashes, there must be a political solution or outcome. Fighting for fighting's sake is really doom for both parties and their descendants. Moshesh promised to abide by my decisions, wrote Wodehouse. But I doubt his power to compel Mutapo and Paulus Mapedi to withdraw their people. So once again, in South African history, we have this moment where there is the letter of the law and then the real world. Wodehouse's view was that the Boers would avoid a war. I can hardly bring myself to believe that the Free State will fairly screw themselves up for a big fight. He had underestimated Bloemfontein's resolve. To make matters more difficult, Mashweshwe had been in poor health for some time, and now his condition was worsening. Among some of his chiefs, this began to erode his authority. It was in this vulnerable moment that two messages arrived, one from Governor Wodehouse confirming the enforcement of the boundary, and the other from President Brandt demanding that the Basutu vacate the disputed land. The missionaries, ever mindful of colonial law, urged Mashweshwe to comply, to follow the letter of the treaties, however bitter the outcome. His son Letsi, whose homesteads lay safely to the south, agreed, but others could not accept this path. Botapo and Mopeti, whose clans lived closest to the line, they stood to lose the most. For a chief's authority was deeply rooted in land, and to surrender it was to surrender power itself.
Where will we go? Where will our children live? Asked Mopeti.
On the 14th of November, Mashweshwe called a pitsu, a major assembly of his chiefs. It was a moment to speak freely, to vent frustration and to wrestle with the reality of what lay ahead. In the end, they publicly committed to accepting Wodehouse's ruling. Mutapo and Mopedi, although reluctant, began evacuating their villages. In the days that followed, a steady stream of men, women and children made their way south, driving cattle, carrying bundles of corn, and taking with them whatever possessions they could manage. When Mashweshwe appealed to President Brandt for time to let Mutapo's people finish harvesting, Brandt agreed. The people stayed through the summer, gathering the last of their crops, and then left in February 1865. By then, the land was quiet. According to British reports and Mashweshwe's own understanding, the disputed territory now stood empty of Basutu. But what neither he nor the British authorities knew was that the Boers were not content to leave it at that. A commando had already been mustered, eager to erase the memory of their defeat in 1858, ready to strike. Resentment hung in the air, hard to ignore, even harder to contain. And despite the chief's public commitment to peace, not everyone in Basutoland was prepared to follow orders. Among the dissenters was Bashori, long known for resisting Mashweshwe's authority. He continued raiding Boer cattle in the south. Meanwhile, Tshekedu was helping himself to horses in the Vinberg district, and Mopedi's followers went even further, taking three Boers hostage. The captives were assaulted, then released, an act that deeply provoked the Free State leadership. A long-standing grievance was beginning to rot at the edges. What had once been a bitter dispute was now starting to fester into something more dangerous. As Leonard Thompson observes in his excellent study, Survival in Two Worlds, Moshweshwe of Lesotho, the principal flashpoint lay in the far northeast, in the rugged highlands near the headwaters of the Caledon River. There, Moshweshwe's nephew and son-in-law, Leswane, had entrenched himself in the mountain strongholds. He had not attended the Pitsu. He had not given his assent to the warden line, and rather than pull back, he escalated the conflict. One by one, he raided Boer homesteads, driving off cattle and leaving a trail of anger behind him. In May 1865, President Brandt gave the order. The commando was released. What began as a show of force meant to pressure Moshweshwe into raiding in Leswane quickly turned into something more serious. Moshweshwe, by now outmatched and increasingly powerless to restrain events, tried to buy time. But Brandt had made up his mind. The presence of Bosotho within the warden line would no longer be tolerated. Leswane was swiftly driven back, retreating before the advancing commando. Yet this wasn't just about one rogue chief. Brandt and the Free State Volksraad behind him had become fixated on a single objective, the total subjugation of the Bosotho. Not containment, not negotiation. The final defeat of a mountain people who had resisted them for too long. On June the 9th, he issued a proclamation full of fire and brimstone. Rise then, burghers of the Orange Free State, to arms in the name of God, for the defense of your rights and the protection of your homesteads and your property. The tenor of the proclamation was a battle cry and spoke of the suppression of the arrogance and violence of the Basutus. You could say that Moshweshwe would probably have used the same words back, the arrogance and violence of a commando heading his way. The Bosotho king issued a counter-blast, more for the British ears than his own people. I am not wishing to fight with the Queen or any of her subjects, but only to protect my people from the aggression of the Free State government. He trusted that the British would stay out of the coming war. His own sin, he said, was that I possess a good and fertile country. This was a conflict long in the making, a war that had been simmering for decades. The Boers and the Bosotho had clashed before, but this time both sides knew it would be decisive. Watching from the wings, as always, was the British Empire, the power that would ultimately shape the outcome, whether by action or omission. And so the war began. 5,000 Boers were mobilized, joined by several hundred volunteers from across Britain's southern African colonies, the Cape, Kaffraria, Natal. They were reinforced by thousands of African allies, including Morocco's Rolong near Tabanchu, long-standing enemies of Moshweshwe, as well as a few hundred Batlokwa and Amamfengu from Morusi's territory in the Witteberg Reserve. Even the South African Republic, the ZAR, sent its own commando to join the campaign. Against this multiracial force stood Moshweshwe and his Bosotho alone. No other African chief came to his aid. In the months leading up to the war, Moshweshwe had reached out. He sent messages to the Zulu court, first to King Mpande, then to the rising figure of Cetshwayo. He appealed to various Tswana leaders, but when the time came, none answered his call. He would face the coming storm without allies. His army numbered around 20,000 men, most armed with traditional weapons, battle axes, spears, and a handful of old muzzle-loading guns. The Boers, by contrast, were upgrading. They were beginning to replace their muskets with the Whitworth breech loader, a modern rifle, faster, more accurate, and deadly at longer range. In terms of firepower, the Free State had a clear advantage. Both sides, though, had artillery, field pieces dragged across rough terrain. The Bosotho had managed to smuggle in a few cannon, and in a remarkable feat of ingenuity, they even cast some of their own, forged from iron with help from British army deserters who'd stayed behind after the previous war, choosing to live among the Bosotho. Once the war was underway, the Bosotho quickly faced a serious challenge. Access to ammunition and essential supplies became increasingly difficult. Meanwhile, the Boers were able to lean on the legal frameworks of the Saint-Rivière and Bloemfontein Conventions, agreements that effectively legitimized their importation of British military equipment. English traders, especially those along the frontier, might have been willing to sell to the Bosotho, but they knew the risks. Boer authorities were vigilant. Any trader caught supplying Mashreshwe could expect retribution. As a result, the flow of supplies to the Basutu slowed to a trickle, then dried up completely. Despite earlier assurances from Governor Wodehouse, the British were far from neutral. Their role echoed modern dynamics, not unlike the relationship between the United States and Israel. By controlling the supply of arms to one side in a war, the British retained significant diplomatic leverage. The Free State depended heavily on the Cape Colony for weapons and ammunition. That dependency gave the British Empire quiet influence, even as it claimed to stand aside. It is also worth noting that neither side entered this conflict from a position of internal stability. In the 11 years since its formation, the Orange Free State had been beset by political infighting and factionalism, cracks in the foundation that were only temporarily set aside in the face of war. The Free State's military commander, Commandant General J.J. Fick, faced a challenge familiar to many Boer commanders, a lack of discipline and cohesion amongst his men. Burghers often came and went as they pleased, reluctant to submit to sustained command. It made coordinated strategy difficult. But in the midst of this loose structure stood President Brandt, the steady figure around which everything turned. The war would mark a turning point, the moment when the Free State began to emerge from years of disorganization and shape itself into a more unified political and military force. Mashreshwe, for his part, remained at Tababusu, the stronghold he had defended in earlier conflicts against both the Boers and the British. He remained calm, as always, watching and waiting from the mountain fortress that had never been taken. At first, this approach worked. The Basutu herded their livestock into the safety of the highlands. Meanwhile, their regiments, under the commanders like Boshodi, Masopa, Botapo, and Leswana, launched a wave of raids into Free State territory. As the main Boer army moved southwards, following a familiar route through the Caledon River Valley, across the Berea Plateau, and toward the foot of Tabobasu, the Basutu harried them at every step. Snipers and raiding parties struck with precision, exploiting the terrain and the element of surprise. In August, a second commando, led by Louis Vepenaar, joined the main army, and he led a group of men up the Rafuto Pass on the northwest side of the mountain under cover of artillery fire. As Vepenaar tried to scale a walled fortification, he was shot dead and his men retreated. The Mountain of the Night had survived another would-be assault from settlers, and Brandt joined a long list of leaders who'd failed to storm its heights. Matawani of the Amangwani, Sekonyela, Mzilikatsi of the Amandebele, Lord Cathcart, who'd led the British army to Tabubusu, then President Bossoff, who'd failed in 1858. Brandt failed again in 1865. At one point, it seemed the Basutu might win this war. Their early raids were effective, their mountain position strong, and morale was high. But then the tide turned. The Free State Army did not retreat. Instead, they dug in and laid siege. In time, they spotted Mashreshwe's main cattle herd high in the mountains. Blocking access to water and grazing land, they waited. Slowly, the animals died of thirst, of hunger, a devastating blow to the Basutu economy and food supply. Governor Wodehouse sought to bring an end to the fighting, but by now, the Free Staters wanted more than a negotiated peace. They wanted finality. They wanted to crush the Basutu resistance once and for all. Though the Transvaal also declared war on Mashreshwe, and Paul Krier himself led a commando, their intervention came to little. Krier's men saw almost no action and withdrew. This was not going to be a joint Boer effort. It was the Free State's war to win or lose. In neighbouring Natal, public opinion was divided. The colony's 16,000 white residents knew little of the Basutu, and most had no stake in the conflict. Only the settlers near Ladysmith had any real knowledge of the kingdom to the west. That changed abruptly when Mashreshwe's chief Leswana launched a raid into Natal and seized cattle from English farmers. It was a diplomatic misstep. Natal's English-speaking settlers, previously ambivalent, now turned sharply against Mashreshwe and demanded reparations. Wodehouse, however, dismissed their demands. He understood the situation more deeply. He knew Leswana had long sought to challenge Mashreshwe's authority and was acting largely on his own. His raid had more to do with internal Basutu rivalries than with any broader strategy. Meanwhile, the war continued in fits and starts. Raids and counter-raids echoed across the Caledon River, from the high headwaters to the rolling hills in the south. In September, the Boers lifted their siege of Tabobusu, and for a time the violence eased. It was planting season. Both the Boers and the Basutu turned to their fields, sowing spring crops as the year drew to a close. But as 1866 began, the Free State regrouped. The Boer commandos were reorganized into four columns, each with a clear mission, and this time they adopted a brutal scorched earth policy. They torched villages, destroyed food stores, and made no distinction between fighters and civilians. Men, women, and children were killed. Crops were burned. Whole communities were erased. The Boers captured enormous herds of sheep and cattle, stripping the Basutu of their food and wealth. By March 1866, famine loomed. The Basutu nation, proud, resourceful, defiant, now faced starvation. When word of atrocities reached Governor Wodehouse, he reacted sharply. He threatened to cut off the Boers' ammunition supply, a powerful move given their reliance on the Cape Colony. He was even more outraged when he discovered that Free State agents had been travelling through the Cape and Natal recruiting African allies and settler volunteers with promises of loot and land. The pressure was beginning to fracture Basutu unity as well. In the north, along the upper reaches of the Caledon River, Chief Morapo, worn down by war, accepted Boer terms of surrender. For Moshoeshoe, it was a devastating blow. One of his most loyal allies had laid down arms. His kingdom was beginning to unravel. As victory seemed within reach for the Boers, a jubilant Free State Volksraad gathered in February 1867. They wasted no time in consolidating their gains. One of their first acts was to expel the Paris evangelical missionaries from Basutu territory, a symbolic blow to Moshoeshoe, who had long relied on their support. By June, the Volksraad passed a series of new laws. No Basutu would be allowed to leave the territory they now called Matapo's Reserve without a pass signed by an official. This reserve lay in the far north of what is now Lesotho, bordered by the towering heights of Monte Sources, the highest point in South Africa. Past laws multiplied on paper. It was clear these laws could not be enforced. The Free State simply didn't have the manpower to police the territory it claimed. By mid-year, the Basutu chiefs met with Moshoeshoe and agreed it was time to sue for peace. What followed became known as the Peace of the Corn, a pause in the conflict, formalized in the Treaty of Thabo Basu. But the treaty was a strategic deception. While the Boers believed the Basutu had capitulated, the Basutu were quietly rebuilding. Fields were replanted, villages rose again from ashes, and without a steady influx of Boer settlers, much of the land actually remained in Basutu hands. The harvest of 1867 was a good one, a stark contrast to the famine and suffering of the year before. Still, this was not a peace in any lasting sense. The war had merely shifted shape. Its chaos, its destruction, and its uncertain end would carry on into the months to come. Folks, South Africa's history is often marked by sudden turns, moments of violence, moments of discovery. Buried treasure, both literal and political, lies hidden until, almost by accident, it surfaces. Often, it's not strategy or foresight, but chance, a misstep, a stray decision that reveals the vast wealth beneath. While the Boers and the Basutu were locked in brutal conflict, fighting for control of fertile valleys and mountain strongholds, something altogether different was unfolding a short distance away. Along the banks of the Orange River, a 15-year-old farmer's son named Erasmus Jacobs wandered about. It was a quiet, ordinary afternoon that December until he kicked a stone. It wasn't just any stone. It caught the light faintly, as though trying to remain hidden. Scuffed, dull, yet with a shimmer just enough to catch a young boy's eye. That single stone, mistaken at first for nothing, would ignite a storm of transformation. The land where Erasmus made his discovery had only recently changed hands, or so claimed the Free State's Volksraad. According to their version, it had been purchased from Adam Kok III, the Griqua leader, before his people trekked out to found Griqualand East. As always in South African history, the land told its own story, but the ownership and the meaning of what lay beneath it would be bitterly contested. In these days, where industrial diamonds are rapidly gaining circulation and sales, it may be difficult to understand the emotions around gemstones that have driven men and women to acts of wanton destruction, cruelty, and political deception. At the top of the list of gems that have captured the minds and sometimes the souls of humans are diamonds. The glimmering sheen of a diamond is both rare and utterly alluring. When Pliny the Elder died in the eruption of Vesuvius AD 79, buried under ash and pumice in Pompeii. The Roman Empire imported diamonds from India and Arabia and Afghanistan. In his Natural History Book 37 on Precious Stones, Pliny says diamonds, or adamas as they were known in Latin, are the most valuable not only of precious stones but of all human possessions, including gold. Their origin, India and Arabia, added to the mystique and value, and they were imbued with magical power. They could resist poison, ward off madness, repel evil spirits, neutralize the effects of a snake bite. The ancient world's artisans used diamonds to cut other precious stones. Pliny's writing preserved the early reputation of the diamond as a near mystical object of indestructibility, purity, power. His work would echo through medieval Renaissance thinking long before the age of geology and modern gemology. In the next episode, we enter the minds of the first prospectors, men stirred by whispers from distant Africa, where a strange glittering stone had been found. What followed was a rush, not just for riches, but for something deeper, an emerald dream that promised fortune, fed obsession, and was said, paradoxically, to cure the very madness it unleashed. Please rate the podcast on your favorite platform that helps elevate its visibility. You can head off to desmondlatham.blog, where I'm loading updates about various episodes. Please email me from there if you want. Until next, voilà.